Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is November the 4th. We are in Zechariah. We are in Perek Yudal, chapter 14, in Treyasar, Zechariah, chapter 14. We started it last week, and we are up to Pasuk Yud, verse 10. Tonight we're planning on finishing Zechariah. So we had learned last time about that there will be the nations of the world will gather and join together to battle against Yerushalayim, and Hashem will wage war against them. We learned about this, the mountain breaking apart and the waterway being created. And the last pasuk we did was the famous pasuk of Vayah Hashem HaMelech al Kol Haaretz. So now we continue in that vein, in Pasuk Yud, verse 10, Yisov kol ha'aretz ka'arava, the whole land will become like a plain. A plain meaning like a flat area. Migeva lirimon, from Geva to Rimon, Negev Yerushalayim, south of Yerushalayim. Apparently, these places, Geva lirimon, is currently a mountainous or hilly area. And Negev Yerushalayim, south of Yerushalayim, is flat. So everything is going to become flat, similar to the south of Yerushalayim. And when that happens, since all the area around Yerushalayim will flatten out, Virama, so Yerushalayim will be lifted up, via Shava Sachteha, it will dwell in its place, meaning it will dwell and it will be noticeable. You'll see Yerushalayim from miles around because everything else is going to be flat, and Yerushalayim will be uplifted, so you'll be able to see it. It'll be distinct. Lemishar Binyamin, from Shar Binyamin, Ad Mekom Shar Harishon, until the place of the Shar Harishon. I'm not sure exactly what each of these things are referencing. Ad Shar Hapinim, to Shar Hapinim, Umigdal Hananel, and Migdal Hananel, the Tower of Hananel, Ad Yikvei HaMelech, until the Yikvei HaMelech. Yikvim are pools that are dug in the ground, like man-made reservoirs that are dug in the ground. So the Yikvei HaMelech are the pools of water that were dug by the king around Yerushalayim. So that the whole area of Yerushalayim will be noticeable because of everything else being flat around it. Now, we know that we find in the Chumash reference several times that Eretz Yisrael is gavoa mikol ha'aratzos. Eretz Yisrael is higher than all lands. And within Eretz Yisrael, Yerushalayim is gavoa mikol Eretz Yisrael. Yerushalayim is the higher than all of Eretz Yisrael. It is unclear when Chazal say that, how they're measuring height.
Spiritually.
So it might mean spiritual. It might mean that. We know that scientifically the way height is measured today is based on sea level. So you measure from whatever is considered sea level, and then you measure from there, and you figure out different mountains, different areas, plateaus, how high they are based on sea level. Based on that, so Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim are not that high above sea level. The Yerushalayim may be higher than many of the areas around it, but it's not going to be high above sea level compared to many of the mountain ranges that are all over the earth. The thing is that measuring height is a tricky thing, because sea level is not, sea level at the end of the day is arbitrary, meaning that's where we've decided to measure from. But it's not that sea level is somehow
it's arbitrary.
Yeah, it's not like it's it's not like it's objectively the way one must measure height, because the earth being round, it's not an exact sphere, it's oblong, and what do you measure from? The ocean floor also is not flat, so, and different ocean floors are deeper than other ocean floors, so where are you going to measure from? And even the ocean itself, it's not like it's all exactly the same. It tends to flux. It could be in flux a little bit. So we don't know what Chazal mean when they say Eretz Yisrael is gavoa mikol ha'aratzos, whether Chazal are saying, as was just suggested, that it just means from a spiritual standpoint, Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim are higher than everywhere else. That's for sure true. And that from a physical standpoint, it is not the case. Or are they measuring height differently than the way height is measured scientifically today? That we don't know.
In what class you said that if you turn the earth on its axis and look measured a different way, then Israel...
Yeah, but that's true of any point on earth.
No, but there was you were talking about the same thing, and you were saying how... If you looked at it from this perspective, that you would see that it really was.
Uh-huh. I'm saying, really, any place, I mean, the earth is, if it's revolving, I don't have an answer to that question. However, over here, we're saying that in the future, the entire area around Yerushalayim will flatten out, leaving Yerushalayim as the only area, the only place that you, for miles around, that will have any height to it. So therefore it will be clearly seen and clearly noticed. Now, we already mentioned last week that Yerushalayim is going to expand. It's going to become much bigger than it is today. There's a machlokus in the Gemara, as we mentioned last week, whether the expansion will be up or out. Meaning, is it going to, the building is going to get taller only, or will the buildings expand further out beyond the borders that there are today? So when it says in the end of Pasuk Yud, at the end of verse 10, Ad Yikveh HaMelech, until Yikveh HaMelech, so as I mentioned, the simple meaning of Yikveh HaMelech would be the reservoirs dug by the king. But the deeper meaning is, it's going to be the pools or the reservoirs or the water holes that were dug by the King of all kings, by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it is actually a reference to the oceans. That is Yikveh HaMelech. The oceans of the world are called Yikveh HaMelech. They are the reservoirs or the water holes that were dug, so to speak, by Hashem. And that Yerushalayim will expand from where it is now all the way to the ocean. That's how big Yerushalayim is going to be.
That means the Mediterranean?
So I assume it means the Mediterranean. That's my assumption. Don't know for sure, but that's my assumption.
My translation say King's wine presses?
Because the wine press had every wine press was built with a pit in the ground to catch the wine. I mean, it was an insulated pit. That when you pressed your wine, it would flow into this pit in the ground. So it doesn't really mean the press, it really means the yekev, the pit in the ground to catch the wine. That's the reference. Okay. Whatever it is, so again, it's unclear exactly how far, but Yerushalayim is going to expand dramatically. And today, Yerushalayim is anyway expanding, as we know, it's constantly getting bigger, there's always more construction. It's going to expand much further than it is today. Pasuk Yud Aleph, V'yashvu va, they will dwell in it. V'cherem lo ye'od, there will no longer be any theft or any kind of bad things happening in the city. V'yashvu Yerushalayim levetach, Yerushalayim will dwell securely. There'll be no problems dwelling in Yerushalayim. V'zos tia magefa, asheyigof Hashem es kol ha'amim, Asher Tzavu al Yerushalayim. And this is going to be the, you want to call it the plague? It's going to be the the punishment that Hashem is going to bring upon. He's going to strike the nations that besieged Jerusalem. This is what's going to happen to them. Those who don't die or who aren't killed, this is what's going to happen to them. Hamek bisaro, their flesh will melt. Vuhu amed al raglav, but he'll be standing on his feet. Meaning, it's not going to kill them. It's not going to make them unable to stand, but their flesh will be afflicted. Ve'inav timakna v'chorehen, and their eyes will melt in their sockets. Ulishono timak b'fihem, and his tongue will melt inside his mouth. So it seems like this doesn't mean that every single one of the people will have every single one of these afflictions, but some of these afflictions will happen to the people who are there. They're going to be afflicted in these ways, which are clearly not wounds that happen from a war, meaning they're clearly going to be from Hashem that they're going to have these afflictions. V'hayah b'yom ahu, will be on that day, tiyem humas Hashem rabba bahem. The confusion that Hashem will inflict upon them will be great among them. They'll be very, very confused. V'hechaziku ish yad re'ehu, each man will grab the hand or the arm of his friend. V'olso yado al yad re'ehu, and he will lift his hand against the hand of his friend. In other words, they will fight with each other. There's going to be such confusion of not knowing who's the enemy anymore. They will fight with each other and beat each other up. They will kill each other as the war is raging. What does that remind you of? That those who are supposed to be friends, they get confused and they start fighting with each other. So this is similar to Migdal Bavel, to the Tower of Babel, where they all joined together, and then Hashem changed their languages, so they were unable to communicate, and then that would cause friction, because this one would ask for something, the other one wouldn't understand, do the other thing, and then they would start to come to blows. Here, they're going to end up fighting with each other.
You say they. Who's the day?
The nations of the world who are besieging Jerusalem.
The Jews that are in Jerusalem will be okay.
They'll be okay. And look at the next pasuk, Yudal 14. Vegam Yehuda tilachem b'Yerushalayim. And also members of Yehuda will wage war with Yerushalayim. We mentioned before that there will be Jews who will be pressed into service. They're going to be members of the army, this massive army that's coming against Yerushalayim. And so they also will wage war with Yerushalayim. But of course, they're not going to want to attack. And once the confusion happens, and once the nations of the world are being decimated by Hashem, the following will happen. V'usaf chel kol hagoyim saviv. The wealth of all the nations around them will be gathered. Meaning, the members of Yehuda who are in the army of the nations of the world, once everything starts to implode, they're going to be able to grab whatever's there, take whatever's there. All of their wealth they will take. Zahav, v'chesef, gold and silver, uvegadim, and clothing, larov ma'od, very much. We started this parak by saying that in the future, v'chulak shvalech b'kirbech, that there'll be a great dividing of spoils in Yerushalayim. This is how it's going to happen. Meaning those very Jews who are going to be forced to be in the non-Jewish army, that's going to work against the non-Jews in the end, because the Jews there will then have the opportunity to take everything from the non-Jews who are beating each other up and simply bring it into Yerushalayim where it will be divided up.
Rabbi, I've never heard of an army that actually takes gold and silver and stuff into war. Usually they leave it in their home country where it's safe.
So the practice was to bring their wealth to war. That was the practice. And the reason why they did it was a ploy the kings used. They brought their wealth to war because they wanted the soldiers to be motivated to fight. And if you lose, then, or you try to escape, run away, you're going to lose all your wealth. And so it was a do or die situation. You had to fight. But the Gemara says that we have it in Pesukim also, that it was common practice to bring wealth to war. Especially the armies that felt that they were invincible. It was showing off their wealth as they fought. So here, for sure, they felt they were invincible. And we're talking about, millions of soldiers against a very small Jewish
army. Wait, are we talking about the future, or what was? I'm confused.
The future. But saying that was common practice, to bring wealth into war.
Is that going to become common practice again?
It seems like they're going to do it. I don't know if it's going to be common practice, but it seems like they're going to do it. Pasuk Tes Vav, V'chein Tia Magifas HaSus HaPered HaGamol VaHaChamor. And the same magefa, the same plague or wounds will be inflicted upon the horses, the mules, the camels, and the donkeys. V'chol ha-behema, and all the animals, asheyeh b'machanos ha-hema, that will be in those camps. Kamagefa hazos, like this same magefa, like this same plague that happens to the people. Now, I always wonder about this, because what are they going to be bringing to war? Are they going to be bringing horses and donkeys and mules and camels to war, which certainly was done in the past? The animals, the beasts of burden, those were their vehicles. The horses were their cars or things that move very quickly, and the mules and the donkeys were their trucks, etc. So that's what they used. So here it says that they will also be similarly afflicted. But today we don't use those things anymore. So I always wonder about this. What does this mean? Are these meant to be symbolic, that those things that are used as horses and donkeys and camels and mules, that they will be destroyed, meaning the equivalent of, the modern equivalent of horses and mules and donkeys, etc. Those things will be afflicted. Or, for some reason, whatever we're using today, tanks and planes and all those things, will somehow not be available, and they will come against Yerushalayim using horses and mules and donkeys and camels. I don't know. It's unclear what that means, how that's going to happen. Pasuk Tezayin, V'hoya kol hanasar mikol hagoyim haba'im al Yerushalayim, and it will be all those who remain amongst the nations who came against Yerushalayim, those who survive, V'alu midei shana v'shana, they will come up year by year, l'ishtachavos, the melech Hashem, to bow to the king Hashem, tzvakos, v'lachog eschag hasukos. So the non-Jews who survive, they will then come each year to bow to Hashem and to celebrate chag hasukos. Sukkos is going to be the yontif that will be available to the non-Jews as well. Now, we know that on Sukkos we offer 70 karbanos, 70 bulls in the Beis HaMikdash. 70 bulls, and those over the seven days of Sukkos, and they correspond to the 70 nations of the world. We also know, the Gemara tells us, that those karbonos would serve to bring bracha to the nations of the world. That when we would offer those karbonos on their behalf, it would bring for them material success and what they needed to live materially. The Gemara says, had the non-Jews known what they would be losing by destroying the Beis HaMikdash, they never would have done it. Not because of compassion for us, but for compassion for themselves. if they would have realized how much they gained by there being a Beis HaMikdash and Karbanos being offered for them, they never would have destroyed it. So those Karbanos for the non-Jews are offered specifically on Sukkot, which means that Sukkot seems to be the Yontif that is more universal than the other Yomim Tovim. Pesach is not a universal Yontif, that's clearly for us. Shavuos is clearly for us. I would have thought Rosh Hashanah would be the one that's for everybody, because Rosh Hashanah really is the day of judgment for everybody, but it's not a festive time. Sukkot is the festive holiday for all people of the world. And we know, of course, that Shmini Atzeres, the eighth day, is that Hashem is, so to speak, saying to us, okay, that was for everybody, and now I want a day just with my favorites, just with the Jews. That's the way we understand Shmini Atzeres. But Sukkot itself seems to be the Yontif that represents everybody. Everybody is able to join into that. Now today, if a non-Jew would take a lulav and esrog, or build a sukkah and sit in a sukkah, they wouldn't do anything. They wouldn't benefit at all, because there is no mitzvah for them to do so. They would be doing something which is meaningless for them, because there's no mitzvah. But in the time of Mashiach, or whenever this pasuk is talking about, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Avodah Zarah, rather well-known Gemara, that when Hashem is going to be giving out reward, so he's going to say that the non-Jews, they don't deserve reward, but the Jews deserve reward. So the non-Jews will say to Hashem, why shouldn't we also be rewarded? And they're going to go back and forth about whether they say, well, if you would have commanded us, we would have done it. Hashem says, no, you rejected the Torah, you didn't accept the Torah. Well, you didn't put a mountain over our heads. There's going to be a back and forth. In the end, Hashem will win the argument, of course, and show them that they do not deserve reward. The Jews who suffered and kept the Torah through all trials and tribulations, they deserve reward, but not the non-Jews. But in the end, Hashem will say, nevertheless, even though your argument does not hold water, I'm going to give you another chance. And that other chance is going to be the mitzvah of sukkah. Specifically, the mitzvah of sukkah will be given to the non-Jews, that they will be told, here's a mitzvah kala, here's an easy mitzvah, go ahead, do the mitzvah, and show me that you also deserve reward. And they will go, and they will build a sukkah, the Gemara says, on top of their roofs, which was a very common place to put a sukkah. If you think about it, if it's a very crowded city, there's not much place to put a sukkah, and on top of the roof, you don't have anything else above it, so you can put a sukkah up. So they're going to put their sukkahs up on top of the roof, and then Hashem is going to be motzi chama min artika, is going to take the sun out of its case, which is actually the same language that is used in the beginning of this week's parashah, Parashas Vayera, when Avraham was waiting for guests, and Hashem took the sun out of its case, so to speak, made it very, very hot. That's what's going to happen then also. He's going to make it very, very hot, oppressively hot. And to the point where the sukkah will not really be habitable. It'll be way too hot to be sitting in a sukkah. So the Gemara says that the non-Jews will kick the sukkah and leave. So Hashem will say, you see, I've proven to you, you don't deserve reward the way the Jews deserve reward. The Gemara asks the question, I don't understand. Why should that show that they don't deserve reward? Jews also do not have to sit in the sukkah if it is that hot. It's mitzvah. A person is very, very uncomfortable. Then there is no mitzvah of sukkah anymore. The Gemara says that is correct. Leaving the sukkah would not be a problem. It is kicking the sukkah on the way out that plays their cards. That's how you see that they don't deserve reward. It's not because they didn't keep the mitzvah. It's because their way of not keeping the mitzvah, their way of showing their contempt for the mitzvah on the way out of the sukkah. That is where you see the difference between the Jews and non-Jews. So first of all, just as a something to take out of that Gemara, which everyone needs to keep in mind, which is that when it is Sukkos, and we have the mitzvah of sitting in the sukkah, so sometimes it does become difficult to do, for whatever reason. It's too hot, it's too cold, it's buggy, whatever. There's reasons why sitting in the sukkah could be uncomfortable, and it could be that in that situation that women certainly, but even men, might not need to sit in the sukkah. So it's important that if we don't need to sit in the sukkah, or we don't have to sit in the sukkah, or we're not able to sit in the sukkah, that we don't walk out with contempt, but rather we walk out with a heavy heart. We wish we could sit in the sukkah, but we can't. Okay, so we go inside. That's one has to be careful not to be dismissive of the special mitzvah. But that's the mitzvah that he's going to give them, which again emphasizes this point that sukkah seems to be the yontif for everybody. And they will be given this mitzvah. It's not one of the Sheva mitzvahs ben Noach now. It's not one of the seven mitzvahs they have. But they'll be given this mitzvah. It'll be an eighth mitzvah that they will have, which is the mitzvah of sukkah. So, of course, that begs the question, why is sukkah the yontif for everybody? And why would they be given specifically the mitzvah of sukkah? It does not say they'd be given the mitzvah of lulav and esrog, but rather the mitzvah of sukkah. So what is so special about the mitzvah of sukkah? So let's move on a little bit, and then we'll discuss that point. So the pasuk says, Yud Zayin 17, V'haya asher lo ya'aleh me'eis mishpachos ha'aretz el Yerushalayim, and it will be those who do not come up from the nations of the world to Yerushalayim, lishtachavos l'melech Hashem Tzvakos, to bow to the king Hashem Tzvakos, they don't come, meaning on Sukkot they don't come, the result will be v'lo alehem yagashem. They will not get rain. They will not get any rain. The rain will not fall on their lands. That will be the punishment. Chazal say, Rashi says it over here, that we know that Sukkot is all about rain. We know that the Arba Minim, the Lulav and the Esrog, they emphasize things that grow, and things that grow in a beautiful way. They have to be, if the lulav and esrog are dried out, they're no good. They have to be moist, they have to be clearly harvested recently. We offer the nisuch hamayim, the water libations, on Sukkot. The whole year round we only pour wine on the Mizbeach. On Sukkot we also pour water. And of course, the whole issue of rain becomes a singular focus on Sukkot. We do not want it to rain on Sukkot, but we do want it to rain after Sukkot. On Shmini Atzeres, we daven Tfilas Geshem, because after Sukkot, we do want it to rain. We just don't want it to rain on Sukkot. So the whole issue of rain, of things that symbolize water and rain, and also the whole issue of rain happening at the right time, not at the wrong time, the right amount of rain, not too much, not too little, not in a way that is destructive, no flooding. This is all incorporated into Sukkot. And therefore, the non-Jews who reject Sukkot, the punishment will be no rain. As we know, on Sukkot we are judged for rain. That's the judgment of Sukkot. Yurches 18. V'mishpachas Mitzrayim lo saleh v'lo va'a. And if the family of Mitzrayim doesn't come up and does not come to Yerushalayim, so the reason why Mitzrayim is being singled out over here is because they don't have any rain. There is no rain in Egypt. They rely on the water of the Nile overflowing its banks in a predictable, cyclical fashion, depending on the season, and that's how their fields become irrigated, and that's how they grow crops. So if they don't come to Yerushalayim, then v'lo aleihem, then they also will not get the rain, meaning they won't get what they need as rain. They will have the same punishment that Hashem will punish the non-Jews, that which is that the Nile will not overflow its banks. What they have as rain is not going to happen. That they don't come up to celebrate Sukkos. Zos tiyeh chatas Mitzrayim. This will be the sin of Mitzrayim, the chatas kol hagoyim, and the sin of all the nations. Ashlo yalu lachog es chag ha-sukos, that they do not come up to celebrate chag ha-sukos. So, again, an emphasis over and over again about the importance of Sukkos and the punishment being that if they don't celebrate Sukkos, the punishment of no rain. Yes?
So what's the difference between coming up and coming to, you know, it says it two ways.
Yeah, I know. It says it both ways.
But then the next pasuk, it doesn't say it both
right.
ways with other people. So what are we supposed to learn from that?
I'm not sure.
Because in the second one, there's no Allah, Aliyah.
I'm not sure. I don't know. I have the same question as you do. I'm not sure the answer. It's a good point. So, so what we have then is we mentioned before, that the non-Jews are specifically invited to join into Sukkos, and the rejection of Sukkos, the specific punishment is rain, is lack of rain. So, what does rain represent? What is rain all about? So, the word geshem, which means rain, is also the word for gashmius. Gashmius means physicality, materialism. Rain is symbolic of gashmius, of materialism. We find that water is the way that Hashem punishes. When Hashem drowns things, let's say with the Mabul, let's say the Egyptians, then it corresponds to averos that have to do with taiva, with indulging. That's where the punishment of drowning is it lines up with the Avera that has to do with indulging. Because the water, the Geshem, represents materialism, and one who indulges too much in materialism, the punishment is too much Geshem, too much rain, too much water. That's the symbolism over there. That's why the Mabul, which was predominantly for the punishment of Gilui Arayus, of immorality, so it was met with a flood. The Egyptians were Shtufei Zima. The Egyptians were entrenched in immorality. And therefore, the primary punishment they got was that of drowning, of rain, of too much water. Here we see the opposite, that the punishment of not participating is to pull the water away, to take the Geshem away. Sukkos is the yontif in which we celebrate. It's the happiest of all of the Yomim Tovim. V'hayisa ach sameach. It mentions simcha three times in the psukim about Sukkos. And it's the time to celebrate, to be happy. We observe that today through Simchas Torah, and also through a Simchas Beis HaShoeva. That's how we do it. Those are conventions in order to be able to have a festive time. But that is, Sukkos is meant to be the happiest of all the Yomim Tovim. That's what it's meant to be. It is in that Yontif that we are also indulging the most, as Rashi explains in Chumash, and the Gemara says, because it's at the end of the harvest, and most of the crops are brought in, and we are celebrating the bounty of the year. So it's a very festive time, but it's a festive time that revolves around Gashmias, that revolves around physicality. We are careful with that physicality to direct it towards the service of Hashem. Just as an aside, we read Koheles on Sukkot. It's for the same reason. Because since there's so much bounty and physicality, materialism about Sukkot, so Koheles serves to put that in perspective of not overindulging and not getting lost in the materialism of the world. The sukkah, going into the sukkah is perhaps the greatest statement that says that for all of the physical bracha that we have, all the wonderful materialism that we have that Hashem has showered upon us, however, we still, that does not cause us to turn away from Hashem. That we voluntarily go out of our homes into a structure that is temporary, that is flimsy, and we rely on the protection of Hashem. When one has all the physical bounty that they can enjoy, then one can easily forget Hashem. That's what the pasuk itself says. Vayishman yeshurun vayivat. Yeshurun, that's the Jews, they became indulgent, vayivat, and they rejected, they literally means that they kicked. They rejected Hashem. It's very easy to do that when we become so entrenched in physicality. We feel that we're independent. We don't need any help. We don't need Hashem. A person who is chas v'shalom in pain, living in fear, has great needs, then they're more likely to turn to Hashem. A person who has everything that they need, doesn't lack for anything, they're less likely to turn to Hashem. We turn to Hashem specifically on Sukkot. Even with everything that we have, we leave it behind and go into the sukkah where we are vulnerable. And when one is vulnerable, one does not forget Hashem. There are no atheists in a foxhole. A person doesn't forget Hashem when they are vulnerable. You're in the sukkah, and it's late at night, and you're trying to sleep, and you hear all the noises outside, and you hear rustling in the bushes. So, you know, your skin starts to, you know, you get goosebumps. You don't forget about Hashem in that situation. You're very, very aware of Hashem's presence. So the going into the sukkah ensures that we're not going to forget about Hashem. And what is the result of forgetting about Hashem? Kicking. Vayiv'at. That's what it says. The Jews became entrenched in indulgent. Vayiv'at, and they kicked. The non-Jews are invited to join in sukkahs. That's what they're invited to join in. Because the sukkahs, more than anything else, emphasizes that we are completely and totally at the mercy of Hashem. But then when they reject the mitzvah, they kick the sukkah. They don't just walk out, but they kick the sukkah. It is symbolic of not accepting Hashem's authority at all, of not just not having the mitzvah, but rejecting Hashem completely, saying we don't need Hashem, we don't need His intervention, we can live without Him. Because of this, the water is taken away, because there again, the other way of Hashem showing that we need Him is by taking away the physicality. Because again, when someone is lacking, then they turn to Hashem. When we have everything, that's when it's easy to reject Hashem, and that's why we go into the sukkah. So it's one or the other. Either go into the sukkah and remind ourselves that we need Him, and if unfortunately we can't do the mitzvah, we walk out with a heavy heart. Or, for those who are going to reject the mitzvah and reject Hashem, then Hashem pulls back the physicality, takes away the rain, and then they're going to have to turn to Him.
I'm having trouble with why water representing Torah at the same time that water is representing Gashmi.
Right.
And Hashem set up the world so that the first thing Adam prayed for was rain.
Right.
So is he praying for Gashmus, or is he praying for Torah, or is he just praying for sustenance?
He's clearly praying, the simple level of there, he's praying for Gashmus. He's praying for things to grow. That's the simple level over there, for sure. It's true, Ein Mayim Ela Torah, that the Torah is compared to water, that is to represent the fact that Torah is life. Like Rabbi Akiva says, that a Jew giving up Torah is like a fish coming out of water. So it's in that regard the Torah is compared to water. And also, the other way that the Gemara says the Torah is compared to water is that water flows to the lowest point, Torah naturally flows to the most humble person, like Moshe Rabbeinu. So in those two ways, Torah is compared to water.
But also you have the mitzvah, which is supposed to be cleansing, and like when the world was flooded, the number 40, like the 40 Seah and the 40, you know, so like sometimes it's cleansing and good, and sometimes it's...
Okay.
How do you know?
I think we find that a lot of times you have things that could be taken in different ways. Pasuk Chaf, verse 20. Bayomer one in that day, Yie al mitzilos hasus kodesh la Hashem. Even though the adornments of a horse will be made sanctified to Hashem, there's going to be so much wealth in Yerushalayim, that even those things that were used to adorn the horse will be made of gold and silver, and they will be sanctified for Hashem. V'haya siros beveis Hashem kamizrakim lifnei hamizbeach. And the siros, a sir is a pot. The pots in the Beis HaMikdash, which are used to cook things, are going to be like the mizrakim. They're going to be like the bowls that are before the Mizbeach. The bowls before the Mizbeach are made of silver. So the pots, which are normally made from a more sturdy metal that's not as beautiful, even those will be made from beautiful metal as well, because there'll be so much wealth that there'll be no need to preserve the wealth for only special things. V'haya kol sir b'Yerushalayim will be Yehuda kodesh to Hashem, and all of the pots in Yerushalayim and Yehuda will be kodesh to Hashem, tzvakos, Uvau kol azovchim, and all of those who offer karbanos will come. V'lakhu mehem, they'll take from them, uvishlu behem, and cook in them. V'lo yechenani od b'meis Hashem tzvakos b'yomahu. And there will no longer be a kenani. Now kenani can obviously mean from Kenan. We also have the word kenani in the Chumash itself that means merchant. We find that with Yehuda that he has a friend, I'm sorry, he takes Tamar as a wife for, no, I'm sorry, how's it going? He, Yehuda, marries Bas Shua. That's who he marries, Bas Shua. And Shua is an Ish Kenani, it says over there. Rashi says over there is a merchant. That's what it means over there. It's a merchant. That's what the word means that as well. So that there'll be no need for merchants anymore in the Beis HaMikdash, because there'll be so much wealth, so there's no need for any more investing or trying to get good deals on things. The Beis HaMikdash will be so flush with wealth in that time, and that's going to be a result of this battle, that all the wealth will end up in Yerushalayim. And that's going to be the ultimate point. It'll be like a funnel, all the wealth of the world coming into Yerushalayim. That's how it's going to end up being. So as again, we don't know the exact sequence of events, how this is going to happen, where this is going to happen, is this immediately after Mashiach comes? Is this prior to Mashiach? We don't really know all of that. We just know that there will be some sort of a battle at some point which will result in these nevuos coming true. And that brings us to the end of Zechariah, which gives us one more sefer for Treyasar. That's Malachi. It has three prakim for Malachi. And Mr. Hashem, we will pick that up next time.
For those of you who do catch up online, with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.